The great writer Pat Conroy died on Friday at age 70. The author of The Great Santini, among many other works, was on our show on November 14, 2013. In nearly 15 years of hosting this show, the conversation with Pat Conroy stood out for its insight, intelligence, and raw humanity. The story of his life with its brutal upbringing by an abusive dad is well known. Less known is his love of a certain bookstore in Atlanta and the English teacher who changed his life. Last night, I pulled out my copy of My Reading Life and reread his inscription to me. To Steve Kraske, for the love of words and story and books, all love and praise to you. Pat Conroy, November 14th, 2013. Here's my conversation with a most beloved son of South Carolina. Well, let's talk about the death of Santini, because your father was such a towering figure in your life, Pat. Of him, you once wrote, "I hated my father long before I knew there was an English word for hate." Tell us about Donald Patrick Conroy.
Well, you know, Dad was, you know, a horrible father. And I can say it in many ways as I can. My brothers and sisters can soften it up a little bit. But speaking for myself, I just thought he was a jerk from the time I came to consciousness until the time I wrote The Great Santini. And my shock was that when I wrote The Great Santini, my father was absolutely stunned by my portrait of him. He hated my portrait of him, despised it. And according to Dad, who was a complete narcissist, he thought he was a great father, a great husband, a great provider. Everything was wonderful. And, you know, my book took him aback.
How could he have been shocked at that point in his life, Pat?
You know, I don't know if anybody ever told guys like that they were jerks. And I'm not sure society in the 50s thought of guys like that as jerks. And, you know, there's been a great revolution in this country of just the way blacks are treated, women are treated, gays are treated. It wasn't like that when Dad was raising me in the 50s.
So how did your book, The Great Santini, how did it strike him? How did he react to it when he read this damning portrait of him that you wrote, his own son wrote?
Like a nuclear bomb.
Really? Yeah.
And his family in Chicago went crazy. I never saw my grandmother again because, you know, she hated the book so much. And I had betrayed the family. It was Judas Iscariot. Even my mother's family, I didn't realize my dad had been charming around my cousins because he was never charming around his own children. And my mother's family hated the book also. But it was the first time it opened any lines of communication up with me and my father. And it was worth it for that.
I mean, did you know you were writing what amounted to a nuclear bomb when you wrote that book?
Yeah, I'd like to say no, but yes, I did.
As a matter of fact.
Yes.
You knew you were taking something of a risk.
I knew that. I didn't know how much of a risk. Yeah. I may have softened it a bit had I known.
So why did you do it? I mean, if you knew you were taking a risk, I mean, why?
Well, I thought this. You know, I had six brothers and sisters, and I'm thinking, we're being ready. If, you know, he doesn't kill somebody, we're going to be lucky. And that's
what
it felt.
Bad.
Oh, it was horrible. And, you know,
lots of violence, back of the hand, slaps, the whole thing.
The backhand was Dad's big thing. And he would backhand my mother to the floor my whole growing up. And I was the oldest son. I'd try to run between them, get between them, and bam, I'd get a backhand, fly out of there. And I'd come running back. And I think my mother, in the weird kind of love that this family produced, the more times I came back to get slapped, the more I loved her. Hmm. And I think something truly hideous was born in those moments.
So when you wrote the book, you say it began to lead to this sort of coming together, this some sense of reconciliation, which is the point of your latest book here.
Right.
I mean, how did that happen? How did you go from nuclear bomb to something of a reconciliation?
Dad disappeared after, you know, he called me up and and I never heard Dad cry. I mean, Dad didn't cry many times in his life. Tough guy.
And he's a Marine. He was a Marine.
Marine. I mean, a tough Marine, too.
Marines can cry, but he was a Marine, yeah.
And he calls me up, and he's finished the book, and he says, "Why do you hate me, son?" And I said, "Dad, you read the last line?" And I said, "That's why I wrote the book, just the last line." He said, "You hate my guts. You hate what I did." And I said, "Yes, I hated all you did." And I had to write that, Dad. I had to get that out because I think it's happening all over America. I think that's going on. And since I could write and I saw it and I was an eyewitness, I felt it was my duty, Colonel, to write it, to get it out. And he disappeared for 3 days, but then his family started attacking from Chicago. And Dad heard this family was attacking his son. And he came roaring back with a letter to all of them saying, "I've read my son's latest work of fiction." He underlined fiction 8 times. He said, "Boy, that kid sure has an imagination." Okay. He underlined imagination. But then he said, "I love my son's Portrait of the Marine Corps, his mother, his brothers and sisters, but he did not have enough talent. He did not have enough skill, he did not have enough creativity to actually get into and know the great Santini himself. He simply lacked that kind of talent."
Was he in denial, Pat?
Yes.
To say the least.
And, yeah. And Dad never admitted he beat my mother or his kids in his lifetime. And he had many good moments before he died. He could not do that one.
And did that fact help give you some sense of respect, even with his own family members, that once even the outer family began to read of some of the horrors that were taking place in your own family, didn't that sort of justify what you wrote, at least in their eyes to some degree?
Okay, I don't know about their eyes, but it's certainly in my eyes. The more Dad denied it, the more real it came. And what I had was there are 5 boys in the family. Those boys were rock hard. Those boys supported me from the day that book came out until now. And I had the sisters wavered some.
Really?
But they didn't get hit like we did. Mm-hmm. But I think it was because Dad did not consider girls important enough to hit. I mean, they simply were inferior products. And it was the boys that had to be shaped and disciplined. Mm-hmm. And he did that extremely well.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the last line of the book. Dad, did you read the last line? The last line was what?
The last line of the book was said...
Can you recall exactly what it was?
I think I can. The last line of The Great Santini, I think, was this. "And on the road to Atlanta, Ben Meacham filled up with the love of his father, with the love of Santini." And I realized I'd been writing this book, tearing my father apart, because I needed to have a father that loved me. For whatever reason, I needed a guy that I could go to who would look at me, "I'm your dad, I love you." And whatever weakness that implied, and with Dad, I think it's a great weakness. He was not that kind of guy. But that is what I turned out to be, that's what I needed, and that's what I wrote in that book. And I said, "The last line surprised me, Dad. I didn't know I was going to write."
And he said?
And he said nothing.
Pat Conroy is our guest, one of this country's great authors. He's called the Great Santini. Why?
He was a 5-year-old kid in Chicago. Went to a circus. It was free. There was a high wire aerialist. And the guy was, and Dad was this 5-year-old kid, and he sees this guy up in the air doing flips, magnificent, charismatic. I mean, he's, you know, up there in that suit of lights that they wear, and muscular, and each flip was more dangerous than the last. And he was called the Great Santini, that aerialist. So when Dad became a pilot and was practicing these maneuvers and these rolls and dives you do in an airplane, he came down and said, I was better than the great Santini today. And the pilots picked it up. And so he was called the great Santini during my whole childhood.
Evermore. Your dad died in 1998. You've waited 15 years to bring out this new book, The Great Santini, about your reconciliation. Why 15 years, Pat?
Well, I had to think about it. You know, I had to come to grips with it. It was, you know, the death was painful to all of us. You know, I think the family had to go through some kind of period of, Dad was such a larger-than-life figure. Mm-hmm. He was like having a Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know, come into the room, you know, whenever he did. And I was writing other books, other novels, and I wanted to let this steep for a while. Mm-hmm. I wanted to let the wine age for a while before I finally went back to him. And when I went back to him and Mom, and I realized there's a story about how I got here, how we all get here, how we are all raised in these families, and what we are born to is what we get. And there is a roll of the dice in that that is extraordinary. Hmm. And we can't do anything about it.
I'm guessing that you would have loved to have had your dad read this book, The Death of Santini.
Yeah, I would have liked it very much. Mm-hmm. Because he would have argued with me about some things. He signed with me for the last 20 years of his life. After The Great Santini came out, he came to a signing one time. And I said, Dad, really? Why don't you sign your book? So Dad would sit there and he would sign old, lovable, likable Don Conroy, Colonel USMC.
No kidding.
And he got to where he signed with every single book I wrote. He and I would sit beside each other.
No kidding.
And I think it was a Marine's way of saying he loved me without having to say it. Mm-hmm. And what I've loved since his death, and what I'd love to tell him now, his signature has become more valuable than mine.
That's the book to have, eh? To have both your signatures.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's even rarer just to have his. And he signed books anywhere at any time.
That's funny. I wanted to ask you about a different book that you wrote a few years ago, just a gem of a book. I just loved it. It's titled My Reading Life, and it chronicles, you know, your love of books, Pat, your love of literature throughout your lifetime. I want to ask you about the bookstore you wrote about, the Old New York Bookshop, which I believe, if I recall correctly, was in Atlanta.
In Atlanta, Georgia.
I mean, it's New York Bookshop. It's in Atlanta. Okay. But you discovered this fairly early in your professional career. Describe it for us, because you do such a marvelous job of describing that bookstore in that book.
When I moved to Atlanta from Beaufort, South Carolina, I did not own any hardbound books. You know,
that was still a luxury for you at that point in your life.
It was a complete luxury, and I came from a paperback family.
Yeah.
And so I walk into this crummy-looking bookstore with handmade shelves and everything else. And Cliff Graubart was the owner there, and you know, I later found out Cliff had never read a book in his life. He could have been selling
hand lotion,
widgets or shoes. Mm-hmm. It didn't make any difference. But I walk into the store and it's like, you know, open sesame for me. You know, I look around these shelves and I'm seeing some of the great writers and great literature in these books, both magnificent and run down, like the store itself. And it changed my life. It completely, everything about my life changed once I found that store.
Because you darn near read the entire store.
Well, here's one thing I didn't know. I knew every book in that store. Hmm. And I think there were 20,000, 25,000 in that store. And boy, I knew them. I knew what I wanted to buy. I knew what I had to save up for. There are things I didn't buy that almost kill me now when I think back on it. But, you know, it was one of those singular life-changing experiences in my life that there was a place I could go, and I feel I got a college education just by walking into that store.
You bought what?
What titles did you pick up?
Okay, everything. All right, now, if I'm writing about the seashore, I go to nature. If I write about mountains, I go to the same place. But if I want to write great books, you know, I go to these novelists, these fabulous novelists that I'd heard about, just said a little bit, never read. Mm-hmm. The foreign novelist, you know, Thomas Mann. I went through all the English novelists. I went through all of Dickens. I, you know, went through George Eliot, whom I came to adore. I went through it all.
And you could afford this stuff, right? You could afford it.
Well, you know, books then were cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, books were very, and especially in an antiquarian bookshop, unless they were first editions. These were very cheap books, and sometimes even less than paperbacks. So it was important to me and good to me that I had this access. And I love that store of my body and soul.
Is it still there?
No, he, you know.
I knew that was going to be the answer.
Every, you know, except for Kansas City, almost every bookstore of worth, you know, closes. Simply because we can't make it with the internet.
You know, there's a marvelous bookstore here, Rainy Day Books, which is bringing you to town for your
presentation. It's a famous bookstore.
It's a famous bookstore. They bring everyone in here. It's a wonderful place. It's in my neighborhood. It's just a terrific place. There was another place, you know, in town a number of years ago, Whistler's Bookstore in Westport, one of those places that always had these sort of, didn't have the best sellers. They always had these offbeat books in there. And I would go in there and they would just take you to different places. And I just miss that place desperately, even to this day. I love Rainy Day Books, but I miss Whistler's because it just had things and titles that you just didn't see anywhere else, you know?
And great towns have bookstores.
Yeah.
And I think the bookstore is coming back.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I'm watching young kids opening bookstores in smaller towns. And a bookstore is good for a town. You know,
yeah.
It's a good place to meet, good place to, you know, drink coffee, good place to discuss ideas. And we're losing those places now. Unless, like my children, there's an object in your right hand where you're twittering to the world constantly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's going to come a time where you want personal relationships much more.
But I would have loved to have seen the old New York bookshop.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. What's there now, do you know? I'm afraid.
You know, I think it is a storage place now.
Yeah, of course. Something like that. Tell us about the English teacher who had such a profound impact on your life. And again, speaking of male figures that you could connect with, Gene Norris.
Gene Norris, one of the great men that ever lived. And when I speak to English students, high school students, I always tell them, I always point to their English teacher, and I said, see that woman? See that guy? Here's what I know now that I've gotten older. You can become, if you love that teacher, you can become their best friend. They need friends as badly as you do.
Yeah.
And with Gene Norris, you know, when he taught me, and he was pure Southern and, you know, gentleman. But I remember him doing things like this. He saw early when I was 15 that I wanted to be a writer. And he didn't say much about it. He would just, I'd write something. I wrote about, he played about the death of Manalete, a bullfighter. And he had us write what we thought. And this is very moving, thinking about this bull and this brilliant bullfighter and this contest. And it was dramatic and it was terrifying. And when I wrote the thing, I just come into his class, and he came up to me and says, hey, boy, you want to be something, don't you? You don't want to be nothing. You want to be something. And I had no idea who he was. So I said, I guess so, sir. And he said, you want to be a writer, don't you, boy? And I nodded my head, and he said, you're the first person in this class who has ever written from the point of view of the bull. And I'm thinking, I now think, that's great teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, he took me to meet the poet laureate of South Carolina 1 month later, a guy named Archibald Rutledge, who lived in a plantation. I mean, my God, he was the most elegant, aristocratic man and ever. And Gene sets up this visit. I meet with him. The guy could not have been sweeter to me. Huh. He has me read his poem. He's just working on it. Ask me for my opinion how he can make it better.
No kidding.
And I said, maybe a stronger adjective here, sir.
Did you?
And I felt, you know, I thought, holy. Then he walked me out and showed me things all over. He says, details. You must know details. So I go out, and I'm flying coming out of that place. I get back in the car with Norris, and he said, what'd you learn, boy? I said, I learned that, you know, antlers of deer are sharpened on cypress knees. And I learned that, you know, the azalea blooms early, you know, with an early, and all of these details that he had told me, Archibald Rutledge, and Mr. Norris says, you didn't learn a thing. You didn't learn nothing. And I thought you were smarter than this. That's what he told me, Mr. Norris. And he said, here's what you learned. If you ever become something, which I doubt, because you're such a no-count, and you're a no-count scalawag. If you ever become something, now you know how to treat a 15-year-old kid that wants to be a writer. And Norris held me to that for the rest of my life. I'd get a phone call, and it'd be Gene Norris. And he'd say, Pat, there's a little girl, and she's up there in Newberry, South Carolina, and she's written a paper on you, and she would love a personal phone call. This happened to me 100 times with Norris. And I said, Norris, I ain't doing anymore. You're wasting my time. I've got a career to make. And he said, well, I remember a little boy in my class. He sure would have loved to hear from him. So I ended up making calls all over the state
for the rest of Gene's life. What a great story, though. What a great mentor. And you were friends with him for decades later,
but,
right?
You know, we called each other every day in the last 5 years of his life. I was one of the executors of his will.